Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to the original Susan Green Show. This is Dr. John Stamey, the host of Scarycast and the host of Wrestling Tonight. And we have got a great show for you. The legendary Susan Green is with us. Susan, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Dr. John. You couldn't be better.
We're so glad to
come back in the ring.
Well, you are climbing back in the ring right now. I'll tell you that. That's a great statement. Yes, you're climbing back in the ring, and you're going to tell everybody all about you. Your history is unbelievable in professional wrestling. So here's what I'd like for you to do. In fact, we decided about an hour and a half ago we were going to start doing this podcast, and that's just the way it is. You know, I'm that way. It's like if it's great, we've got to do it. So what I'd like for you to do, you were telling us or telling me all about being from Alice, Texas, and being trained by Joe Blanchard. Could you just start telling everybody your story and how all that happened? Because I know that everyone is going to be interested in this. Okay?
Okay. I was born August the 13th, 1953, in Alice, Texas. My mother had to have the doctor had sit there and said, was she superstitious? And she said no. So I had to be born by a C-section. And when I was delivered, the umbilical cord was wrapped around my throat. And whenever I was delivered, he sat there and told my mother that my name would be in lights. And lo and behold, when I wrestled in Houston, Texas, the promoter there, Paul Bosch, had put my name since I was and Houston's 300 miles away from where I was, that my name would be in lights, and he had put up on the billboard Susie Green, because I was still in high school. It was my junior year of high school, and I was doing it on the weekend, and my mother had sat there and said, well, I guess Dr. Williams was right, your name's in lights.
So what was really the first time that you wrestled professionally?
August the 13th, 1969, my 15th birthday. My parents had to go before Governor John Conley so I could get a wrestler's license. Was not able to get a driver's license at the time because I was too young, but I had to go before the governor so that they could see and they could assure him that this was not a child labor thing, for him to let the commission issue me a wrestling license. And so on my 15th birthday, I had my very first match against Marie De Leon there in Victoria.
So how did that go? Tell us about that match.
I was scared to death. I was 112 pounds. There's probably 300 people there at the auction barn where we had the matches there in Victoria. I got beat pretty well. I mean, and Joe just sat there and said, well, you know, she's got 30 pounds on you. But I thought, being 112 pounds, I was pretty heavy because I played tennis and swam in high school. And at that time, we were pretty lean being in tennis and swimming. It was looking across at her, you know, and then people. And, of course, Joe was one of those, you know, my name was unique enough being Green. He just didn't have a habit of changing anybody's name. So he just, you know, he kept my name as what everybody knew me as Susie, you know, because swimming in high school, they all knew me as Susie, and playing tennis across the South Texas, they all knew me as Susie. So he just kept my name to where whenever I'd be wrestling somewhere, if they saw the name, they would know, because everybody knew from the time I was in elementary school that I wanted to be a wrestler. And it only took me 10 years to bribe Joe Blanchard to give me a shot at wrestling. Hard that he would change me.
So your first match was not a success. So what happened after that? How did your wrestling career proceed after that first match?
Since I was only able to wrestle on weekends or on the holidays, I trained every day. I would drive my sister would drive me over. My brother would drive me over to Corpus, where Joe had a training school, and I would work out with the men. I was the only female that ever showed any interest to want to be a wrestler, so I was the only one there. So I'd be working out 3 or 4 hours after I got out of my training from swimming, and my swimming was before school, and the tennis was after school. And at 5 o'clock, we'd drive over to Corpus, and I would train till 7 o'clock, and then drive back home and do whatever homework I didn't get done on the drive over, and then be ready to get to the swim pool at 6 o'clock the next morning for the swimming. But
wow,
didn't
that,
have
that,
a lot
that
of
is
success.
Incredible. Pardon
my first 2 years of wrestling, I didn't have a lot of success because I was wrestling women that had been wrestling 10, 15, 20 years. You know, Kay Noble, Barbara Glento, Jean Antone, Betty Nicolai, Evelyn Stevens. I said most of these have passed. Now, Marie De Leon's still on. She's in the bodybuilding now. But the rest of them, most of them, all that I mentioned have passed. But it's been one of those that you sit there and you hear somebody's going. And then, of course, a lot of the people that I've met on the road that are way younger than I am, this past year, some young ones have passed. In fact, some of the Glow girls, I'd went out whenever Jackie Stallone had started Glow and helped train some of the girls in the beginning of Glow starting, and it was more too choreographed for me to want to be in. You know, I mean, I didn't, I'm farm girl and cheerleader and all, but I said that's what Jackie Stallone wanted, and it was like, well, whatever you want, you know, all I got to teach them is the holds and the how to fall and keep themselves from getting concussions. And also, but I met quite a few of those awesome, Mount Fuji, away, I think 2 years ago. Met a lot of great people throughout my wrestling career.
Because wouldn't you say that in general, the wrestlers that are successful are really wonderful people?
Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't you say that there's a certain positivity that they have that just transcends everything, and as a wrestling fan, I've been a wrestling fan all my life. I'm over 50 years old, and I love wrestling, and I think the wrestlers that I have met have been just incredible, and thanks for agreeing with me. I mean, if you don't mind expanding on that, you know, tell about a little bit about the positivity of the great wrestlers that you've worked with and met, if you don't mind.
Yeah, the ones that are really great. You know, we all look back, and if it wasn't for the fans, we wouldn't be who we were. You know, and we all would maybe not talk that much. I talked at the arenas. I know I left Dallas when they were holding a plane for me, when they would hold a plane. Because I had to be in St. Louis, and I was running, and a young man was in a wheelchair. He was my autograph, but I let my bag go sliding, and I went sliding to a stop and went back to him to give him my autograph. And said, you know, I'm sorry, but I can't talk. I've got to go. They're holding a plane for me. And then Fritz Von Erich had one of the guys rush me to the airport to get there to catch the plane to St. Louis. But, it's most of us away from the arenas, if they caught us at the motels, I mean, everybody would talk to the fans. It's just promoters, when they had the ones that nobody was supposed to like, then, you know, they had to keep that image up at the arena. In fact, I can tell you one, incident that happened in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Randy Tyler was one of the most hated tag team partners with his brother there, you know, Rip Tyler, and he had got stabbed walking to the ring, and they got him back, and I'd already wrestled him. I had just got my 73 Galaxy. I drove it from Corpus Christi to Baton Rouge, and we called the ambulance, which was maybe four blocks away from the arena. And it wasn't coming, it wasn't coming, it wasn't coming. And I sit there and I finally told Randy, you know, wrap this towel around him. And we had two or three towels wrapped around him. He said, I can't get in your car and get blood. And I said, the blood will come off. You know, you're going to sit there because you can hear it start gurgling. You know, he's bleeding into his lung. And, of course, got him to the hospital. And they said, yeah, well, the ambulance is on its way. And I said, well, it should have been there long ago. You know, this is him. Forget the ambulance. And the people, if they didn't like you, if they were in the ambulance, they wouldn't come get you. You know, so we depended on a lot of the other wrestlers, male or female. And I sit there and told Randy, I said, you know, it doesn't matter. You're a male, whether they like you or not. You're a friend of mine. I'm not going to let you sit here and bleed to death. So, the next day, you know, when he was able to help get out there, he was helping wiping the blood out of my car from where he bled all over the seats and all. But, you know, it was one of those that he would have probably bled to death right there in the dressing room if I wouldn't have got him to the hospital. I guess traveling, I've been on the road a lot, probably been around the world with Ric Flair. And nothing has ever really happened to us.
Well, now I've got to stop you. We all love Ric Flair.
Yeah.
There's something. Well, there was just something special, don't you think, about Ric Flair?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I love him to death, but he can scare you to death whenever he's driving. You know,
Susan, we're going to get him on the original Susan Green show, and we're going to get him to talk about that, and he's going to have to come. Now Rick's going to have to come clean about how bad of a driver he was. Is that fair enough?
Well, I won't say he's a bad driver. He just likes to go fast.
Well, as I said, he's going to have to come clean about being a driver, and we'll have him certainly on the original Susan Green show. But that's
that
great.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Now I've got to ask you a question, and this is very important to me, and I think to all of the wrestling fans in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You ended up in Columbia, South Carolina, and that's where you live now, because you came here and studied and worked with the fabulous Moolah. Do you mind telling us the story of you and Moolah, and do you mind doing that?
Me and Moolah Lillian, and I guess that's where everybody else would call her Moo or Moolah, and I called her Lillian or Miss Ellisor. Now, I don't know if she legally had her name changed to Ellison or not, but her last name truly is Ellisor. It's got an R, not an N on it. And that's how I was introduced to her by Joe Blanchard. He called from my parents' house, and I came out, and I said, well, and it was before I graduated in 71. And she said, could I be here on June the 5th of 71? And they said, yes. So I had my brand new 71 Torino that I got for graduation. And we drove out. My mother came with me. Well, Moolah thought that my mother was going to drive back. And of course, she took the plane. And of course, my mother had a phone put in the trailer that I was staying at. And everyone was saying, you can't have a phone in your house. We all make our phone calls down there. And I said, well, that's a rule that my parents have. I have a phone. So I was kind of the rebel at the camp of Moolah. And there was a match I had with her in 75 in Dallas. And it was Dory Funk Jr. was the world champion, and he was going to be wrestling Ivan Putski. And this is the story you're wanting, isn't it? And I was wrestling Moolah with a 45-minute time limit, and Fritz Von Erich came in and said, you know, y'all go as close to the time limit as you can. No problem. And they brought Mike Mazurki in, and a lot of people, if you don't know the name Mike Mazurki, he was the original Frankenstein in the movies back in the 50s. So they brought him here in to be the special referee, and I said, you know, he was a giant, close to 7 foot tall. So I sit there and I said, you know, not heavy or anything, but I sit there and said that he, whenever we was out in the middle of the ring getting instructions, Miller just reached up and slapped me. You know, no reason whatsoever. And then, of course, my head spun one way, and I looked back, and then all I could say is, beat me if you can. And Mike Mazurki sat there and said, oh, my God. You know, so I went back over to the corner and took my jacket off and my hat off and went about the little merry way and was wrestling, doing our thing, and she was hitting hard. Well, I was hitting just hard back. Well, I got her in the middle of the ring. Well, I wasn't 120 pounds or 128 pounds because she wanted all the girls to weigh under 130, you know, because she'd say she was 135, and I'd sit there and said she was 170. And she'd lay on us to where we couldn't throw her off. Now, I'm weighing 212 pounds because whenever she sent me out to California, Roy Shires in Northern California that ran the Cow Palace in Northern California, he wanted me different, Martin, and the difference was he wanted me over 200 pounds. Well, the deal was if Mula wanted to book the girls in Northern California, I was going to be on the card, and I had to be over 200 pounds. Well, I couldn't be putting weight on and taking weight off, so. And most of the promoters liked me at the 200 pounds. You know, and at 212, everything was good. Well, I ended up hooking her in the middle of the ring at 200 in an Indian death lock, which it's with the legs. And if you push down on the knees, it will end up separating the hips. Well, I was in the middle of the ring, and at 212 pounds, she couldn't drag me to the ropes so she could break the hold. And she looked up at Mike Mazurki and asked him, how much longer? And then just nonchalantly, I said, oh, about 23. And Mike looked down at her and said, she's right. And I said, I can hold out. Can you? Well, of course, she sat there and said, you know, and there was no tap at back in those days. You had to say, I quit. Well, she sat there and said it very lightly to Mike that she quit. And I sat there and he said, you know, break the hold, she quit. And I said, what'd she say? I had her screaming at the top of her lungs to where everybody in that sportatorium in Dallas could hear her say I quit before I let her out of the ring and or let her out of the hold. And then when I broke the hold, you know, I got the belt and I went back. Well, she grabbed her bags and had Fritz Von Erich take her to the airport, and she didn't show up for the rest of the booking. Well, they called Mike Mazurki or Sam Mushnick, he was the president of NWA, and said,
Sam,
you know,
Mushnick,
what,
yes, yeah, he was, yeah. Yeah, in fact, if I remember correctly, he came out of Florida Championship Wrestling. He was yeah. The man, wasn't he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was a man that made all the calls for NWA. So he called and he sat there and said, you know, Fritz said, you know, Green beat Mula, and said, well, tell her to beat her in Fort Worth tomorrow night. And she said, that's just it. She can't. You know, this girl's tough. And he says, well, that's Mula's belt. That's not the NWA's belt. You know, and if you look at the belt, it's actually got the date that Mula won the belt with her name on it. You know, it's small, but it has the date that she won it in Baltimore at a tournament. And Mula actually had the belt made for her to win the belt, because that's whenever her and Buddy Lee were doing the promotion, booking the girls. And she was married to Buddy Lee at the time. And all, but I sat there and said that with that, I ended up carrying the belt. I drove a wrecker, because I learned if you didn't have a job, you're going to have to work around the compound, you know, painting houses or mowing. And I was the only one that could make that 47 Ford tractor run that had a bush hog on it and mow that 25 acres. And I didn't mind doing it because, you know, I got sun doing it, you know, and then with all the ways laying out, getting sun or inside painting. And I said, you know, I didn't like slinging paint. So I got to work, and I'd rather be making money than sitting there sweating and not making any. So I started driving the wrecker for her boyfriend. And whenever he found out.
Who was her boyfriend?
CDL.
What was his name? What was his name?
This one was Bobby Mathis. You know, he owned Mathis Garage, and he worked on most of the girls' cars because he could keep them running. If they didn't have the money to pay, they could have a bill with him and pay when they could. I drove the wrecker and made money all the time. And of course, she tried to get him to take 30% of that money because I was under contract to her. And then I had to sit there and he wouldn't. He said, you know, you get it from her. And I said, my contract with you is when I'm in the ring between the ropes. It's not when I'm behind the wheel on the road. And so I always had money. And then I also played in a band and we played at her bar one night and she took 30% off the top. And the lead singer that formed the band had to jump on her and say, you know, she don't get a third of the pay because she don't sing. All she does is play the bass. So, you know, she learned real fast. She wasn't going to get any of the money from me playing in a band or any of the money of me driving the wrecker. And whenever I'd come home, I'd just go park my car in the lot at the garage and get in the wrecker. Because back then in the 60s and 70s and 80s, if you listened to the radio, and you just ran and talked to victims into letting you pull. You didn't have a call list waiting for somebody, the highway patrol, to call you to come pick up a wreck. You know, so I said, you know, I made money. I always had money. And, of course, she always sent me on the road with the girls that didn't have any money, and they'd depend on me to be able to feed them until I was able to draw in advance or get stuff. But whenever I beat her, they're in Dallas, and she flew out, and Stan Mushnick sat there and said that wasn't the NWA women's belt. That was her belt. She'd have to figure out how to get it back. Well, Vince Sr. flew me up to Connecticut, and when I walked in, there she sat. Well, I sit there, and we was talking, and I said, well, what's she here? And he said, you know, I think you know why she's here. And I said, well, yeah, I probably do, but you're not going to find what you're looking for. Well, of course, when I got back from the airport, back from Connecticut, my car had been gone through at the airport, and of course, my apartment had been gone through. And whenever she'd got a call, when we were sitting there, and said, you know, we're going to have to make the deal. Well, I made him bring one of his paralegals up and draw up a contract that I no longer had to wrestle her. I no longer had to pay her any percentage, but it would be in between the door down at the foot of her, because if she came down her steps out of her bedroom, there was a door right there going to the outside. She'd put it between the two doors, and I would get it without having to wake her up when I got it back into town. Oh, I would knock on the door until she gave me my money. Yeah. And then, of course, in 76, she made me move off the land, but she still had to book me, you know, which I ended up. With that, I ended up getting to wrestle a lot of independents, and she had to sit there and let me know 2 weeks ahead of time because I was also able to get bookings on my own. So my last 3 years at Moolah's, I was able to book myself as well as take the bookings with her, but I knew I had the West Coast bookings because Roy Shires, the one that worked Northern California, wanted me and with that. And then in July of 79, when I had my neck and back broke in a boating accident, she sent word to buy Bobby, the boyfriend, which that was the end of his, I guess that was about the end of their relationship in 79. I mean, but he came in and sat there and said that Moolah thinks this is the best thing that happened to you, you getting your neck and back broke. And I just sat there and looked at him and said, you tell her I'll be back. And of course, my parents had me flown out to Texas for rehabilitation, and it was 2.5 years of learning to walk and being able to get back in the ring, and of course it was Joe Blanchard that gave me the chance to get back in the ring, even with all the doctors telling me I shouldn't, with my neck and back being broke. You know, and I said, because I say, you know, it doesn't matter how deep you cut me, when it's in your heart, wrestling is a sport you don't walk away from if it's truly in your heart. You know, you might be able to get away from it a while, or you might have to do something else, but it's something that, you know, you just can't turn your back on. So, you know,
it's really funny, Susan. It's like me. I mean, I've been an announcer in the wrestling business. I love wrestling. It's not going to go away from me. So, I think you're 100% right. If it's in you, yeah. It's in you. Correct?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And you know, in the contract that they drew up, you know, Vince had to pay me $1,200 cash. He had to pay the other attorney to look over the contract that I had drawn up and make sure everything was legal, that there was no way they could get out of it. And I actually hid the belt at the bus station, you know, in one of the lockers at the bus station. So she had no idea where that belt was. And when I went and got it and handed it back to her, I've actually got a picture of me handing the belt back to her in Madison Square Garden. And that night I wrestled Paula Kay and she wrestled Vivian St. John in a title match. And I said, until that night, she didn't have the belt. You know, I still had the belt. And she said, well, let me have it so I can go out. And I said, I'm not giving you the belt back until I get the picture of me handing it back to you. So, you know, the photographers had to come in and get the picture of me handing the belt back to her.
So let me ask you this. You do have that picture, correct?
Yes, I do have that picture.
All right. Well, will you let us put it on your new website, SusanTexGreen.com? Will you let us please
Definitely.
Do that?
Definitely. And I have a picture of me when I wrestled for Mildred Burke, because whenever I left in 1974 for 3 months, I went to Mildred Burke, and Mildred Burke put the actual NWA women's world belt on me. I have a picture of me with that belt on me, and I was dark-headed. Yeah. And then when I left Mildred, you know, I was with her for 3 months and sat there and said, you know, I wanted to go other places besides Japan and Mexico. And she said, well, Mula's kind of got that tied up. And I said, well, I guess I have to go back. And of course, Mula came back to me and sat there and said that, you know, don't think what happens to you out there is going to happen to you here. You know, of course, didn't have to. I beat her and I won the belt in 1975 from her, and I kept it for 131 days, and Vince had to buy it back for her. And you know, I got $1,200 for it, but it wasn't worth anything to me. And $1,200 back in 1975 was a lot of money. But you know, wasn't going to bring me anything. It had her name on it. But, you know,
excuse me. Certainly understand that you did great things. You've won many, many belts. You've been the world.
I've been around the world, that's for sure.
Yep, that's right. So what would you say was the most exciting moment of your wrestling life?
I guess whenever the most exciting part was, I wrestled there and I guess I'm beating Mula. I wasn't all that exciting. It was just I was showing her I could do it. So exciting wise was wrestling in front of the Queen, Queen Elizabeth. They set
now,
the ring
again.
Up and
please,
I wrestled
please
for the Queen.
Talk about it.
Yeah, I wrestled for the Queen, Queen Elizabeth, there in Buckingham Palace. You know,
so tell us all, please. That's a great story. Tell us about that, please.
It was one of those that Rhonda Singh, you know, had some matches, and she sat down and said, we may not see her, and we may not, you know, but we did see her. We wasn't able to get any pictures or anything, but, you know, she sat there, and because we walked by after the matches, she sat there and said, you know, y'all look like y'all should be extremely hurt with all that we did, you know. But, you know, we weren't able to reach out to touch or get any pictures or anything. But there at Buckingham Palace, they set up a ring. And promoters did the show saying that they wanted to do. You know, so I guess that'd be
that's kind of something that a lot of people wouldn't know about. that you'd wrestled at Buckingham Palace. Can you, like, give us a little more background about how it all happened and everything?
Wrestling for a promoter in London, he started doing shows and asking wrestlers, would they? Well, there was a lot of the guys that, you know, didn't actually believe that we were. And then Bobby Shane, he was on the show. I don't remember who he was wrestling, but he's one of the ones. In fact, he's the guy that worked with me when I was still training for Joe Blanchard, that taught me how to do the head scissors and the drop kicks. You know, and because that's it. When people tell me they can't, I always tell them, you know, there's no such word, because that was Bobby's way of telling me, you know, you can do it if you want to do it. But there was only about six of us that went, so it was really just a short and sweet promoter sat down and said, everybody else is not going to believe that y'all did this. You know, you're going to have to really rub it in their face. And I said, you know, we was all kind of rubbing it in their face. I know a couple of the guys were from Mexico because they was on the tour with us. That Rhonda knew. But I sat there and said it was truly exciting to see be inside the palace and how they had the stuff set up, you know. And I said, they'd sit there and, you know, we was able to change in one of the, and I said the bathroom they had us changing in. It was like a palace, you know. I mean, it could have been a room. It didn't have to be just a bathroom. It was so big. And then, of course, they took us back to the motel for us to be able to do all our showering and everything. It was just, you know, change and leave. And we was leaving. We were bowing to the queen.
Wow, that is incredible. And now let me ask you this. I don't think this is a story that you've ever told before, is it?
No.
This is wonderful. And I can tell you about my experience with wrestling, because I was just a kid in Morganton, North Carolina. I was so eaten up with wrestling. And now I'm lucky enough to know people like you and Papa Stro, the maestro of wrestling and everything. And I actually got my dad to let me put a figure four leg lock on him. And he said, son, this hurts. I said, what? It hurts? And then I kept doing it. He said, son, stop. This hurts. And I was, when I was convinced. And I want to say this. I am convinced that wrestling is real. I don't care if you are out there and, you know, you know what the result is going to be. But I'll tell you what, wrestling is real. Wrestling hurt. I've got a question to ask you. It's the most important question of all time. Can wrestling hurt? Yes or no?
Yes. I am considered what a lot of people call a shooter, a hooker, or a worker. If you want to work, I can go out there and do what you want to do. I mean, do what the promoter wants. If I want to hurt you, I can go out and be finished in just 30 seconds. I can have you beat and be walking out of there, because I'm not considered a shooter, you know. And the reason you say a shooter, it's like you just pull the trigger and it's over. And the hooker is, I'm going to put you in. And that's what I did to Moolah when I put her in the Indian deathlock. I hooked her in that hold and she couldn't move. And the more she wiggled, the worse it hurt. So she had no choice but to give up, you know. So, you know, I can play the game any way you want to play the game. But if you don't know how to fall, you know, I've had quite a few people come over and I end up flipping myself in my front yard. And it's like, you know, we're the one that I want you to show. And I said, I can do this on concrete, you know. You know, I've taken a shoulder-to-shoulder standing suplex from other women and no pad around the ring and able to get up. You know, you got to know how to land. Yes, it hurts, but you just learn how to take the bruises. You know, it's just part of the job, you know.
It's part of the job.
A lot of people that do a lot of typing.
People
that do a lot of typing.
I'm going to make sure that we all know,
you know,
it's part of the job, right?
Yeah, it's part of the job, you know. It just, you know, you know how to fall, and the concussions, you know, I don't believe in getting the headshots with those chairs and all that, because that's definitely, you're looking for concussions. There's times whenever you get hit with a shot, and then you're basically going on instinct. You're no longer fighting. You're out there knowing what you're supposed to do. And whenever I'm training somebody here at my gym, you know, I tell them I'll train you from 5 minutes to 3 hours. But when your head becomes a basketball, that's when we stop, because you know, I'm not going to let you keep bouncing your head around. Because my ring is the ring that I trained in with. I call him Bob, which he became Blackjack Mulligan. Johnny Valentine, Thunderbolt Patterson, Toru Tanaka, Mount Fuji's been in the ring that I train all the guys in that I train. You know, I've done some repairs, and I have different canvases put on, but it's the actual ring, and I cut it down lower because whenever I was moving everything back out here from Texas, I forgot my ring, and I wasn't leaving my ring. You know, my ring was coming with me, so I had to cut the legs down to get it to fit in the U-Haul truck that I was driving. When everybody comes out and looks, you know, it's surprising when they walk through the door, and they call it a barn, and I call it my gym, to see that I got the ring. And they said, "You really got a ring." And I thought, well, how else would I train you? You know,
absolutely. You know, how else?
You know, you kind of need the ring to be able to do the rest of the job. But,
right. Exactly. All right. Well, here's what I'd like to ask you: of the people that you've trained, tell me about some of them, because I know we'd love to hear about it. Because, you know, Susan, your career is one that just stands out in terms of the entire world of wrestling. So who have you trained?
When I was there at Moolah's, I tried to talk Patty, which became Lalani Kai, out of coming. I told her there was other places she could go, and there was other places she could go. Of course, her uncle was Toru Tanaka, and I picked her up in Augusta, Georgia, and no, she was
really?
Coming. She was coming.
Her
she was
uncle
coming.
Was Toru Tanaka. I'm
yeah.
sorry for talking over you, but really,
yeah.
Oh my God, that's
yeah.
unbelievable.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah. But I trained her. Now, most of the people that I trained, because they paid Moolah. So I guess they think whoever they paid is the one that trained them. Miller would come out and say, I got 3 weeks to get this one ready for the ring. Joyce Grable, Betty Murphy was her name, and Valerie saw her, went up to Miller in Columbus, Georgia, and said, you know, I want to come to your training school. And she said, well, you know, you come, but bring your friend. And that's when she brought Betty, which Miller ended up naming Betty Joyce Grable. Well, I trained Joyce in 3 weeks. And if you look on the YouTube, if you see the match of me and Joyce against Tony Rose and Miller, that was Joyce's first match at Atlanta TV. We was on our way to Alabama for Gulf Coast Wrestling. You know, we were going there for 2 weeks, but we stopped in Friday morning to do Atlanta TV. By Train Joyce, I guess one of the biggest names that came down here that I didn't really train her, I had a couple of workouts with her, was Joni, which is AKA China. She came here and I got her, I said, China, you know, and because Kowalski had told her you need to be trained by a girl, and I said, China, you're trained. There's nothing different between a man and a woman. A hole's a hole is a hole. You know, it's just, you know, it's a hole, you know. I called a promoter that I knew in Holland, and he said, you know, could we get her over there? And I said, well, I think she has her passport, and I checked, and he got her visa and everything all set up for her, and she went over and wrestled for 25 days, and then he was going to take her sightseeing, and I said, you know, got to understand that we've given WWF paperwork and everything and pictures, and she's been talking to them. But she possibly get the call, and she's got to be in New York or in Connecticut if they call her within 72 hours if she wants to get the contract. Well, they ended up catching her, and she made it back in I think they said 47 hours when she was walking through the door at the WWF Titan Sports building to get her first contract. And of course, I'd sit there and told her, I said, you know, in China, they're going to try to get you on steroids. And, oh, no, I won't do that, because she was a natural bodybuilder where, you know, all she did was do the natural. And of course, she was a graduate from the university, and I don't remember exactly what it was in. I want to say health science, like she could go into physical therapy and all. But as you could tell by the end, she was into taking something to get the muscles that she got. I won't say what she was on, but that somehow she was never that big. But a promoter over in Europe, they were all wanting us to come back over there and me to put my hair, either her to go blonde or me to put my hair back to its natural color, because we look so much like sisters. Because, I was just a little bit taller than her. She was like 5'10". You know, they shot up to everybody who thought that she was so much bigger, and then she wore those boots that had those 3-inch heels or 3-inch soles on them. So it made her look so much bigger than she was. Johnny was one, I guess, my one that made the biggest impact, and then Alani Kai would be the next one that made a huge impact on wrestling. A couple of girls, Sheba Estrada was out of Texas, and when she had a son that she realized after training that she wasn't going to be able to go on the road to wrestle. And then my niece I actually trained. She's the one that inducted me into the PWHF out there in Texas. And when I was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2017.
What was your niece's name?
She was going to be going as Debbie Kay, because that's what I called her. I always called her by her middle name, and everybody knew she was my niece. So we were going to form a tag team there for Joe Blanchard, and go up against he had Barbara Glinto and Kay Noble out of Amarillo. They said they'd come down and, you know, we'd cover the whole state of Texas, but it was going to be hard for my niece, because her son, they didn't realize till he was 4 years old that he was deaf. So, you know, they were having trouble. And she said she went and leaving her. And I said, I don't blame her. So, you know, she ended up dropping out and just doing a few matches around South Texas when Kay and Barbara was able to come down and work the south part of Texas. You know, we wasn't able to travel the whole state. And then Debbie Johnson is another one I trained that was there at Moolah's that didn't really go very far. Dottie Downs was another one that didn't go very far. Dottie was really older. She was probably already in her 50s when she tried to do, and Debbie Johnson was her was Dottie's daughter, and I guess Moolah thought that Dottie would drop out and go back to Kentucky, but she hung around, and whenever they both ended up leaving together, you know, whenever they got fed up with not getting the bookings. And I'd sit there and tell a lot of people, you know, we were, a lot of us were young and dumb, and when Moolah needed money, we were on the road busy as we could be and staying on the road. You know, if otherwise we were there to be the entertainment painted and keep the grounds kept, you know, because back in the 70s, nobody lived on the property except the female wrestlers. You know, none of us left and most of us behind her back called her the warden, and that we was in the prison compound. Of course, I had a motorcycle that I could push out the back way and then crank and go out the back roads or go to push through the woods and get away to where she didn't know I was there or not. You know, if my car was there, she thought I was there. but I had other wheels that I could get around on. Most of the girls didn't have cars, you know, that they weren't able to go anywhere because being out there where she lived, we were so far out. It was 5 miles to get anywhere. And, of course, the taxi couldn't come in. So, you know, and we didn't have cell phones back in the 70s, and none of us were making enough money to be able to afford a bag phone back in the day. So, but I said, me and Lillian, we ended up learning to respect each other, but we didn't like each other. You know, we just, you know, and nobody ever knew. And Tony Rose, you know, to this day, she says, I never knew that. And I said, Tony, I got kicked off the property in 76. I said, she still booked me. And I said, I mainly worked the girls that was the wives of the other wrestlers in the other territories. I didn't, or I worked the new girls, that she had coming in that didn't know me. She would drop them off at a Maverick Market, and then I'd pick them up to where they wouldn't know that, and it was like, don't tell them you was one of my girls. It's like, all right, whatever you say. I said, but the contract had stated that I wouldn't say that she bought the belt back. And if anybody watches that video of me wrestling Kitty Adams in Madison Square Garden, if they listen to the commentating, and they hear about Mila's collarbone was broke the night before, well, I'm the one that broke her collarbone because she was making me wrestle with broke ribs that night and called me a wuss. And I said, I'm no wuss. She tried to keep me from giving her a bill. Well, I told her, you call the spot, you're taking it. Well, she tried to hang on to the rope, and I put enough force in the move to it snapped her collarbone in her left, in her right shoulder. The next day, I was flying out to Texas, and she was coming back to South Carolina, and I had to push her through customs because the Tunney sat there and said, I said, I don't mind. I'll just explain I'm going on, and I got her to her gate to get depart to South Columbia, and I went to my gate to depart to Texas. So, she had to live with being out of work for 6 months because I broke her collarbone, but she didn't want to own up that I'm the one that broke her collarbone. But if you listen to the deal, I'd wrestled her in Madison Square Garden the night before and broke her collarbone. And then the referee, when I started getting out of the ring, he said, you got two more falls to go. The match ain't over. This one, hadn't even took a fall. And I said, it's over for her. And whenever she spun around on her knee, she had her threw her hand up over her collarbone. And you saw the blood trickle down. It was a compound break, And he said, oh, my God, and I just walked out of the ring and left, because back in the 70s, you didn't lose a belt if you didn't continue all three falls. If you got disqualified, you didn't lose a belt, or, you had to be pinned to lose the belt. So I knew that it was going to be over. I just didn't know who I was going to fight the next night in Madison Square Garden. And that's when they called Kitty Adams in, because Kitty lived in Rhode Island.
She wasn't a very good wrestler, frankly. And I'm sorry for saying that.
If you look at all the matches, look at the matches she had with Vicki Williams, and then look at a match that she had with her 6 months later, it's the same match. You look at the match she had with me, 6 months later, it's the same match. She did the same thing over and over and over and over. And I was the only girl that she had that would come off the top rope with that big splash. Now, I could hit anybody else with a big splash, but she didn't, that's how she wanted to always beat me whenever I came off the top rope. I could beat anybody else with that big splash, but that was going to be how she beat me. I was going to miss it. And I thought, you're not really beating me. I'm beating myself by missing the move. So that you know, and I said, when I beat her, she had no choice but to say, I give up. So it wasn't that I beaten, you know, that she beat herself. I beat her. You know, so, but.
Well, you know, hers is actually the first match comes up with you on, on YouTube. So, yeah. So anyway, but anyway, look, Susan, it has been wonderful talking with you. And we're going, you and
anytime.
I, are you ready? Are you ready to start bringing some of your friends that wrestled with you, and we can continue this every week on Tuesday night at 8:30?
Yeah, it'd be great.
Okay, well, that's great.
Grab some of them.
Well,
if they're still kicking, I'll try to get a hold of them.
That's right. Well, you start doing that, and we'll start making this happen. And I think everyone's going to enjoy this because you know the real story about wrestling.
I wanted to thank you. Yeah.
Pardon?
Well, I thank you for letting me have, I'm thanking you for letting me have a chance to say this. You know, today I couldn't be the acrobats that these girls are, but I can tell you this, that there's not very many out there now that can do what me, Donna Christintello, Tony Rose, Kay Noble, Barbara Galento, we did. They wouldn't have been able to take the training that we had to go through. Now, tell me I have to do a 1.5 flip off the top rope, and I told them that's crazy. You know, because that was one thing, Bobby. You know, Bobby said, you know, whenever you come off the top rope, you know where you're going to land. You know, you don't go flipping and wonder where you're going. But I wouldn't want to depend on somebody catching me coming that high off the rope and flying off the top rope, going to the ground. There's no wonder they've all got messed up knees and some of them, like Lita, broke her neck, you know, that ended her career, you know. But
yeah, well, I tell you what, having you on here has been incredible. So let me ask you this. Are you ready? Are we going to start the Susan Text Green podcast? Are you ready to do that?
Sounds like I'm ready to do that. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, again, when I met you, and I've got to tell everyone, I met you at my favorite place, which is Maurice's Barbecue, and I thought you were one of the coolest people I ever met. Honestly, honestly, I think you were one of the coolest people I ever met. So thank you for being here, and the Susan Text Green podcast will start next week, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and I'll see you there, okay?
Okay, sounds like a deal.
Susan, thank you so much. It's a pleasure, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, so pleasure and fine. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.